The T-Biz podcast delivers tea news that you need to know. A recap of the week's major headlines with commentary and cultural trends hosted by Dan Bolton. It is the voice of origin for tea professionals and enthusiasts worldwide.
Each year, the T-Biz portal publishes the State of the Tea Industry Forecast, a forward-looking assessment of production, pricing, trade, and demand. We invite tea professionals across the value chain to review the findings and contribute their perspective. Your insights help refine the forecast before it is finalized on March 1st.
Hello, everyone. Here are this week's headlines. Assam enters commercial matcha production. Caffeine labels could work in tea's favor. And floods threaten the world's largest jasmine harvest. Plus, when tea becomes more than a product, building ritual, community, and trust without losing authenticity. Tea is often described in terms of origin, cultivar, elevation, and craft, but another dimension is harder to quantify and increasingly central to how people engage with tea, and that's presence. Across the specialty market, we are seeing a shift. Not just towards better tea, but towards more intentional ways of experiencing it. Spaces designed for slowing down, for attention, for connection. The language of ritual and mindfulness is everywhere. But that raises a critical question for the industry. What is real and what is simply being repackaged? Today's guest operates directly inside that tension. Flowing River, also known as Luong Shin, is a poet, a ceremonialist, and co-founder of Drushti House in Santa Barbara, California. It is a space built not around consumption, but around shared presence, where tea becomes a medium for conversation, reflection, and community. He's also the author of The Flowing River, a collection written over a decade-long personal journey that traces grief, identity, and ultimately surrender. In this conversation, we explore what it means to build a tea practice, not just a tea brand, where the line between authenticity and performance sits, and what, if anything, from the ceremonial tea culture can translate into a viable modern business model. More in a minute, but first, this important message.
What makes a perfect cup of Ceylon tea? The perfect cup is from the tea businesses that ensure the protection of all the children living within their tea estates. We salute Keilani Valley, Telawakili, Bogawanthalawa, Harana, and Eliptia Tea Estates. Support Save the Children, Sri Lanka.
Assam, one of the world's best-known black tea origins, has made its first commercial move into matcha. A 5-kilogram lot produced at Chota Ting Rai Tea Estate in Upper Assam sold on the Guwahati Tea Auction Center for 3,000 rupees per kilogram. It's about $31 U.S. Regional reporting describes this as India's first commercially manufactured matcha and the result of nearly a decade of collaboration with Chinese tea experts. 5 kilograms is not a commercial sale, but this is strategically important because Assam is testing a premium, highly processed tea format at a time when global matcha demand is expanding rapidly and Japanese supplies remain tight. Matcha, however, is not simply ordinary green tea ground into powder. Production begins in the field. Tea plants are shaded before harvest to influence color, sweetness, and umami. The harvested leaf is processed into tencha, with stems and veins removed before milling into an extremely fine powder. Quality depends on cultivar, shading, harvest timing, processing, milling temperature, particle size, color, aroma, and flavor. Food safety is especially important because matcha tea drinkers consume the entire leaf. Buyers will expect dependable testing for pesticide residues, microorganisms, and heavy metals, along with strong traceability. The 3,000 rupee auction price validates buyer curiosity and does not yet validate commercial scale. A psalmist now demonstrated that it can consistently reproduce the quality, expand production economically, and develop a product that performs well beyond the novelty of being Indian matcha. The timing creates an opportunity. Rapid growth in cafes, food service, confectionery, and home consumption has strained the Japanese matcha supply. But a shortage does not eliminate quality expectations. Japan remains the global reference point because its leading producers combine specialized cultivars, generations of technical knowledge, established tencha production, and exacting sensory standards. Buyers evaluating some matcha should look closely at cultivar shading, milling, color retention, particle size, flavor, and food safety performance. They should also determine where the product fits. Could Assam produce premium drinking matcha, a competitively priced cafe grade, a reliable ingredient for food manufacturers, or a distinct regional style with its own sensory identity? Those answers will matter more than the first auction price. The development also comes as Assam producers seek relief from persistent cost pressure. The Tea Association of India recently welcomed government incentives for orthodox and specialty tea while requesting additional relief from the green leaf cess. Premium diversification may provide one route towards higher realizations, but only when innovation becomes repeatable and profitable. Business Insight. Assam should not define its matcha simply as a substitute for the scarce Japanese supply. The greater opportunity lies in creating a credible expression of Assam matcha, supported by transparent production methods, rigorous testing, consistent quality, and dependable volume. The first 5 kilos earned attention. The next harvests must earn trust. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is taking a closer look at caffeine labeling, and the outcome could influence beverage packaging well beyond the United States. The FDA has added caffeine content labeling for foods and beverages to its 2026 guidance agenda. No binding rule has been proposed, and the details remain uncertain, but the agency is examining how companies communicate caffeine content in packaged products and potentially in restaurants and other retail settings. For tea, the central question is whether regulators treat naturally occurring caffeine differently from caffeine added to energy drinks and functional beverages. At present, U.S. companies generally must identify added caffeine as an ingredient, but they are not required to state how many milligrams a product contains. Naturally occurring caffeine in tea and coffee is usually not declared. Consumers appear ready for greater clarity on this matter. Caffeine is consumed by more than 9 in 10 Americans, but many people do not know how much they consume or what a reasonable daily amount might be given their height and weight. For tea, greater transparency could be an advantage. Tea generally delivers less caffeine than brewed coffee and many energy drinks. FDA estimates place a typical 12-ounce black tea at about 71 milligrams compared to 113 to 247 milligrams for brewed coffee. But tea creates a labeling challenge because caffeine is not fixed. The amount in the cup changes with the cultivar, leaf, dose, water temperature, and steeping time. A bottled tea can be tested precisely, but a loose-leaf tea prepared at home may require a representative range of brewing times depending on standard brewing instructions. Many tea companies have already anticipated this decision. Lipton publishes caffeine ranges for several teas. David's Tea sorts products into caffeine-free, low-caffeine, medium, and high categories. The Republic of Tea provides estimated milligram counts for many products and precise disclosure on the higher-caffeine teas. That experience suggests disclosure need not be viewed merely as regulatory compliance. It can also help consumers select tea according to the time of day, desired energy level, or sensitivity to caffeine. The international effect could also be significant. Major brands often design packaging for several markets, and U.S. guidance could accelerate a broader movement towards standardization of caffeine disclosure. Canada, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand already apply various labeling and warning requirements to high caffeine beverages. For tea companies, the best response is preparation, not opposition. Begin documenting caffeine ranges, establish standard brewing assumptions, review testing capabilities, and clearly distinguish natural caffeine in tea from caffeine extracted from products and added to the brew. Business insight. In a market crowded with highly caffeinated energy products, transparency may strengthen tea's position. Tea can offer something increasingly valuable: moderate stimulation, naturally delivered and clearly explained. Severe flooding in Guangxi has inundated jasmine fields in Hangzhou, China, disrupting the harvest during the year's most important production period and threatening the world's most concentrated source of jasmine flowers. Hangzhou produces more than 80% of China's jasmine flowers and an estimated 60% of the global supply. The flowers are essential to traditional jasmine tea and increasingly important to China's fast-growing market for jasmine melt tea, ready-to-drink beverages, and specialty coffee. Days of intense rainfall following tropical storm Maisak overwhelmed rivers and reservoirs. Floodwaters spread across villages and low-lying farmland during the peak summer jasmine harvest. Growers described fields as almost entirely submerged and said plucking had stopped in many communities. The damage may extend well beyond flowers that cannot be harvested this week, however. Jasmine does not tolerate prolonged waterlogging. Growers told Chinese media that several days underwater may reduce flowering and damage quality. Longer periods of inundation will kill the plants, requiring fields to be replanted. But reports that the entire Hangzhou crop had been destroyed are premature. Regional businesses report that damage varies considerably. Low-lying farms have been severely affected, while some fields on higher ground or with better drainage escaped the worst of the flooding. Authorities have not yet completed a comprehensive agricultural loss assessment because rescue operations remain the priority and roads to several production areas remain inaccessible. For tea buyers, the first impact may be uncertainty rather than immediate scarcity. The fresh flower collection has been interrupted during a critical scenting period. Reduced availability could raise processing costs and increase competition among traditional tea companies and large beverage chains. The greater concern is concentration. Guangzhou's extraordinary production scale made jasmine affordable and accessible worldwide. But when one region supplies most of the market, a reservoir breach, typhoon, or prolonged flooding becomes a global industry risk. The next several days will determine how quickly the water recedes and whether surviving plants can recover in time to produce additional flowers before the season ends. Quality lifts Colombo and North India. The Week 27 Tea Price Report for the period ending July 5th is sponsored by the East Africa Tea Trade Association, EATTA, owners of the Mombasa Tea Auction since 1956. Tea markets closed week 27 with a firmer basis, but the strength was concentrated in quality rather than spread evenly across the catalogs. Buyers remained active for immediate coverage and disciplined on secondary teas. Colombo improved as offerings declined and product quality gradually strengthened. Better westerns and selected low-growns attracted more activity, while plainer descriptions remained sensitive to valuation. North India was the strongest mover, with the latest official data showing renewed gains in Kolkata and Guwahati and little change in Siliguri. Mombasa saw good general demand, although unsold volume and the continuing difficulty of executing exports through the disrupted Middle East corridors kept the market selective. Indonesia reported fair demand and a broadly steady indicative tone. In Colombo, prices averaged $3.55 per kilogram this week, up 10 cents versus the previous week, sale 24. In North India, prices averaged $2.62 per kilogram, up 8 cents from the last available average week, number 25. In Mombasa, sales averaged $2.33 per kilo, up 1 cent versus the prior indicative benchmark, also sales 25. In Indonesia, prices averaged $2.41 per kilogram, flat versus the prior indicative benchmark for week 26. Across the four markets, quality segmentation remains the dominant pricing mechanism. Exporters are resisting lower bids where currency stability and embedded costs support price floors, but buyers are not building speculative positions. Freight insurance, packaging, and finance remain important, particularly for lower value teas where logistics consume a larger share of the delivered price. The takeaway is that headline averages are firming without a broad demand breakout. Traders should watch quality, clearance, and export execution separately, and the best teas are moving with competition, while weaker descriptions still need accurate pricing to clear. That's the Tea Price Report for week 27, ending 5 July 2026. Subscribe for free to the T-Biz newsletter on LinkedIn for a detailed regional breakdown, six-month trade signals, and near-term outlook for quarter three pricing dynamics. And now, a word from this week's sponsor, Brewmaker One.
Hello, I'm Bogdan, a passionate tea drinker and the inventor of the ultimate tea machine, the Brewmaker One. Preparation is key to making fine tea. Sequential steepings deliver the best taste possible and unlock the true value of whole leaf teas and botanicals. Brew automates that process without using any pots or capsules. This simple-to-operate, smartphone-controlled device stores steeping profiles to consistently make great tea at the push of a button. Brew also reduces time, waste, and energy. That's because I engineered the brew to remember control settings for temperature, brewing time, and quantity. Using my patented process lets you stack steep simply and conveniently.
Tea is often described in terms of origin, cultivar, elevation, and craft, but there is another dimension that is harder to quantify and increasingly central to how people engage with tea today. Presence. Across the specialty market, we are seeing a shift, not just towards better tea, but towards more intentional ways of experiencing it. Spaces designed for slowing down, for attention, for connection. The language of ritual and mindfulness is everywhere. But that raises a critical question for the industry. What is real and what is simply being repackaged? Today's guest operates directly inside that tension. Flowing River, also known as Luong Shin, is a poet, ceremonialist, and co-founder of Drishti House in Santa Barbara, California. It is a space built not around consumption, but around shared presence, where tea becomes a medium for conversation, reflection, and community. He's also the author of The Flowing River, a collection of 221 poems written over a decade-long personal journey that traces spiritual awakening, love, grief, service, identity, and ultimately, surrender. He has led more than 1,000 gatherings, from silent tea ceremonies to immersive retreats. In this conversation, we explore what it means to build a tea practice, not just a tea brand, where the line between authenticity and performance sits, and what, if anything, from ceremonial tea culture can translate into a viable modern business model. River and Drishti House, tea is treated as ritual rather than commodity. How do you turn something so personal and experiential into business without reducing it to another wellness product?
That's a great question. And it is experiential. And I think that's the way that humanity has been functioning as a marketing business model for millennia, since the beginning of time. I feel like it's been word of mouth, and it's about quality, and it's about something that's tangible, something that's visceral, something that makes you want to speak to another about the experience you had. And in this day and age, like with fast fashion and fast food and fast this and fast that, it's like the quality and the craftsmanship. And I'm sure you've seen it in your own lifetime, where back in the day, there used to be architecture that was just in the town square, and it's a piece of art, like people took pride in beauty. People took pride in craft. People took pride in their worth. It was a representation of who they are. If you take that product and it was not good, that's dishonorable to your name and your family, and your name was everything. We've completely, unfortunately, seemingly have lost touch with that concept and have turned every single person into a statistic, which means that the bottom line is not aligned with our intention of our heart or the expression of our souls, but is now beholden to shareholders that are trying to maximize profit. And so that's a great parallel between Lipton and what maybe a tea estate in southern China that's 7th generation, 14th generation, 20th generation is carrying. And the difference in the experience of the tea is night and day. You cannot even compare the two. I dare not even call Lipton tea. It's difficult for me to call it tea because it lacks L-theanine. And scientifically, you can see this, that lower quality tea that isn't grown in the proper conditions or doesn't receive enough shade isn't going to have L-theanine. You're going to have a completely different experience, not to mention all the chemical compounds that go into that tea, from fertilizer, herbalizer, herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, all the sides going inside and creating a different experience on a physiological level for people. So I think, it's very intimate. It's very personal, but, when people sit with proper tea that was grown with proper intention, stored with proper intention, served with proper intention, and received with proper intention, then the cycle of tea for me is complete. And that experience is something that people will never forget. They will say, wow, that is not my grandmother's tea. And they are right. Exactly. People will ask me, they'll say, did you put psychedelics in that tea? Did you put something in the tea? I'm like, no, that is just Camila.
The tea industry is increasingly using terms such as mindfulness, ceremony, and presence. From your perspective, where does that language become performative or extractive? And what does integrity look like in practice?
The moment that you try to make a profit from it is the moment that's a transaction, and the moment that is a transaction is not authentic to truth. So the moment you try to turn mindfulness into a business is no longer mindful. You're in business, and that's fine. You can use your mind, but it's not the essence of spirit. Consciousness itself has given everything to us for free and continually gives us to free. That is unconditional love. That is the great, most beautiful currency that there is that we can remember how to trade in, right? But the moment you put business into it, it's not that, because now there's energy exchange. So business can never be that which is given away for free from the heart. And if you wish to be in true integrity with the way of tea, of what you're speaking about, then there's just something that is cannot be faked. You're talking about this authenticity. It's like a vibrational thing. It's like you go into a space and somebody just recognizes you and is like, hey, let's have a tea ceremony. I'm happy to serve you tea. They may not even present themselves as a tea master, but there's something in that tea that's unspoken that brings you back to a deep remembrance that was before any of capitalistic society or commercialization of tea came about, because that is the way that tea wishes to present itself to the larger society. Now, what humans do with their intentions, overlaying that for commercialization, that's fine. There's no wrong or right way to do tea. But if you want to get to authentic tea, if you seek tea, tea will find you. And it's a beautiful game. And, you know, I encourage everyone to go deep within to understand what is their relationship with tea and see what tea is trying to teach you, so to speak. So the other part of it, though, is the performative aspect. And let's just speak to maybe more surface level of this question is there's two levels of this in tea ceremony and Cha Dao, the way of tea. And there's so many expressions of this Japanese tea ceremony. And if you go to China, as you're alluding to, there's just infinite variations. Taiwanese have their own way. The English have their own way. You know, the Indians have their own way. Everyone has their own beautiful way of expressing tea. And some of that is performative, like as you say. Is there any function to it other than egotistical or to draw attention or to sell something? That's fine, commercialism of it. But the true way of tea, they teach us that as a server, you want to get out of the way. You want to serve the tea in such a way that you're not even present, like the tea serves itself. So how can you get to a place of emptiness within yourself where you may be performing a form in your tea ceremony, but you're not doing it for any other reason to help facilitate, to hold space for people to come into the presence of the moment and have that internal remembrance. Because if you're bringing the focus outside of your guests, that is performing. If you're helping facilitate the guests to go deeper within themselves, then this is the way of tea, as far as that I've experienced and the way that it's been taught to me. I have no teachings of myself, so I'm just sharing the wisdom that has been passed down to me.
From a practical standpoint, what elements are non-negotiable for a truly immersive tea experience? Is it the selection of teas, the water, the space, the pacing, or the person who serves the tea?
The first is you're only as good as your foundation, right? So let's start with the physical nature of tea. Like the highest quality tea for me is, let's just all remember when we were children, you know, and you were sick. And it's like you could buy instant chicken noodle soup from ramen noodle soup, or your mother could make that chicken noodle soup. Which one's actually going to heal you? Right. And for some reason, when my mom ever made me chicken noodle soup, I was like healed the next day. I don't know what it was, but it's her love and her intention in that noodle soup that I feel shifted it for my personal experience versus if I just bought something off the shelf and just put it in a microwave. And that is the same foundation I look for in tea. Who is the tea master? Because I'm not the tea master. The one who is cultivating the tea, tending the land. You know, maybe they're praying over that tea. Maybe they're singing song over that tea. Maybe they carry certain mindfulness practices of their own as they're cultivating and processing that tea. That is, for me, step one. And if you can't get to the tea farm or the tea estate, then you can go to the distributor. And who is the distributor that is storing that tea? Because I love to work with aged tea, so puer. Or other iterations of HT, but how do they store that tea? Is there a reverence, or are they just looking at it as a speculative product that they're just trying to flip like it's a real estate deal? Because this intention shifts the experience of the tea in the way that I've personally sat with tea that is, okay, it's a cash crop, or it's grandma's picking the tea leaf and, you know, they actually care for the tree as something that is near and dear to their heart. So I look for reverence in the cultivation, processing, and storage of the tea as the baseline, that it's non-negotiable. And not only that, as you drink more tea, you will become more sensitive to understand what tea is grown with a certain level of intention versus what tea is just kind of thrown on a conveyor belt and slammed into micro bags filled with microplastic. And, you know, I feel like everyone finds the perfect tea for them wherever they're at in their search. But if you demand quality or you seek quality, like I said, that quality tea will find you. The next thing I think important is the cultivation of a space. Now, a lot of people don't have, let's say, like I'm sitting right now in one of our tea lounges. Maybe you don't have space for a tea lounge or a tea house. That's okay, because if you cultivate that space with just reverence in your heart and make it like an altar, a place where people can come to practice, it's going to carry that energy, right? And a lot of people make a big deal about tea ware and things like that. And it's true, it can change the flavor profile. It can change how you experience the tea from a flavor standpoint, but it's not going to change the baseline of the tea. So you don't want to get too caught up in, oh, do I have the $5,000 teapot versus a $5 teapot? The best tea is the tea that you're making, right? But there's something about when you can create space, and I feel like the Japanese do a really good job of this, of creating this concept of openness. Because sometimes when you have clutter and things like that, and that's fine, there's many different expressions of tea, but I feel like that it's a representation of the place that you're attempting to go to or be guided to. So I love the concept of Zen minimalism in tea, because it's an external representation of where the ceremony is guiding you internally. And it's kind of like an earmark to be like, oh, wow, there's, my mind is clear. I don't see so much all around me. Let me go to that space of clarity within myself. And so you can see that it's a preparation from the facilitator in those spaces to be like, okay, what is outside? We're trying to show you that's also a place within you, that sanctuary of peace, that place where your mind is slowed down, where, you know, it's not being bombarded by thoughts or negativity all the time, which is a very common thing that we deal with in the West. So tea has that ability to slow us to that place. The other thing, and the most important thing out of all this puzzle piece of tea, is twofold. One is the water, because tea is 99% water.
Right.
So very important to get high quality water. And in China, all the tea sages, they always talk about getting fresh spring water. And of course, who has fresh spring water available? Unfortunately, those corporations have done a lot of damage to our ecosystem. So it's very difficult to find fresh spring water these days. But you can get RO water, you can get distilled water, you can remineralize your water. You can get certain kettles that have certain clays that kind of flavor the water in a way to get really higher quality water. And lastly, it's you as the tea server, which I truly believe is very important, because you yourself must, like you alluded to, not be performative, but be a facilitator for space holding. And if your mind is coming into the tea ceremony and people are meditating, like, this is going to be a distraction. So it's your job to have your own mindfulness practice, your own meditation practice, your own connection, whichever way that you can get to that place, and show up as an empty vessel.
Many tea businesses talk about community, but few actually build one. What have you learned about creating genuine, recurring participation rather than a one-time experience?
People are attached to looking at humans as statistics and collecting numbers and feeling this pressure. I need to have 100 people in my event, otherwise it's not successful, which is a very common entrepreneurial mindset, because we're so goal-oriented. And when you're just pursuing that, you're never satisfied, and you're just looking at people as a commodity, perhaps, and you're just trying to, like you alluded before, extract energy from people. People can feel this. Like, this is something that is kind of like an ick. And I think that this comes with a level of a feeling of like desperation. Like, if you come into a communal space and, you know, oh, here's my pamphlet and let me sell you on this and let me upgrade you to that and let me get you in the funnel. And there are places and spaces where that's championed and that's quite common. And I don't go to those places. I've learned, you know, and I think people that haven't learned yet, they might think that that works for them. But in true communal spaces, it feels more like a hearth. you know, like of a fireplace. It feels like that feeling where you're holding that cup and you feel safe. And when you, that warmth comes into your body and your body begins to melt, your shoulders go down. Maybe this fight or flight sensation goes down and you feel like I can just lean back in my chair and relax, you know, and I can be myself. I don't need to be performative, right? And I feel like those are good hallmarks of community where you're accepted for who you are, no matter where you came from, what color you are, what your social status is. And when people feel accepted fully, truly, then I think that they've arrived in a true community. And another thing about it is, you know, being able to be seen when you can also, one thing in tea is the guest, the tea is important, the space, everything that you mentioned is important, but the guest, without the guest, there is no tea. There is no tea ceremony. So it's not just a guest, it's a guest of honor. So everything is actually positioned for our guests at Jersey House, especially in the way of tea. And so if somebody's coming to your community, you only have a community because they're joining you. If you're the leader of that community or you're facilitating that community or part of it, then you should treat them like an honored guest. They should not be treated as a statistic. They should be treated as, wow, thank you for joining us, that I, you're giving me purpose in my life, you know? And this is a beautiful perspective that one could have to cultivate in their own community. One last thing too is in the communities that we build, there's no effort to attach. Like, yes, you have business, you have a mindset to, you know, not be sustainable, but to thrive. Like as business, you're in business to continue to grow and proliferate and spread and scale, as you mentioned before. But if you have an energy of grabbing, 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 I think that the more you try to grab it, the more it's running away from you, you know? And when you have an energy of just holding space and allowing what will come to you to come and collect, it's like a non-attachment to if people come in your community or they go. And the reason you have that non-attachment is because you know who you are, which is what you alluded before. You know what you stand for. You know the quality of your product. You stand by that. Let those people go somewhere else. Let them go to another community. Let them drink somebody else's tea. That's fine. But you know you got the best tea and you know you got the best community. So guess what they're going to come back to? On a long enough timeline, they will come back straight back to the tea house, or they'll come back to your community in whatever it is you're doing. But it's your job to source the best tea, serve the best tea, and, you know, cultivate that space where people are seen, honored, and respected. And I think like that's the best way to build community. It also takes the longest, perhaps. You know, I don't dictate when the community grows or not, like, but people start talking and word of mouth is the best, still the best and most powerful form of marketing. So if you're in it for business, then take that into consideration, because you can do the rabbit route and raise money and get a bunch of money to, you know, do online ads and targeted ads to who you think is attracted to your tea. And if you have a good product, maybe that's a great strategy. Or you can take the turtle route, slowly build through direct experience, through heart connection, through focusing on quality. And the funny thing is, when I look at it in hindsight, it's like, I can't really tell, like, who went further. Is it the guy who, male or female, when I reference guy, is it the person who focused on their craft for 15 years and then finally came out of the closet and said, this is mastery? Or is it the person that did the mass marketing and made millions of dollars and has 1,000 people working under them?
For a business owner who wants to incorporate ceremonial or intentional gathering, where's the most authentic place to start? And what should they avoid if they do not want to feel contrived?
I would say to start, you have to start with the man in the mirror. You know, man or woman in the mirror. And you have to get clear with what is your purpose. Are you here to serve yourself, or are you here to serve your community or your society or the world at large? And in that service, like, what is your, you know, zone of genius, people like to say, and pursue that, you know, and it should be something that you wake up to where it doesn't feel like work. you should wake up and you should feel joy to serve in whichever capacity that you are. Then guess what? It's not a job. It's just play at that point. And then when you play, you can't contrive it. You can't fake it because there's no script. There's no lines you're trying to rehearse. It's just an extension of your beingness. It's an extension of, you know, the intention of your heart. And I think that comes off as what you've coined as authentic. And people can feel that. And when people feel that and people resonate and on that tequency, then those are the best tea ceremonies. Those are the best tea parties. And I feel like that's the best tea that one can indulge in. So the advice would be, ask yourself, you know, what you stand for, and find those core values that represent whatever business that you're in. And if it's in tea, you know, cultivate those core values. On our website, you can see our core values. We have the four up there as an example. And then from that core, it's like the extension of the way that you're going to present yourself to the world. So off of, let's say, harmony, how can we create a harmonious environment when somebody comes into our space? Maybe I need to go out and study harmony and cultivate harmony within myself and cultivate harmony within my family first before I can offer it to somebody else, right? So that's how that kind of works. And then, you know, as far as like graphics and visual and things like that, that will waterfall afterwards. I would say that you don't have to think so much about that because it will just naturally rise as an extension of your intention, as an extension of the purpose of your business. And there's no problem with having lofty goals. Okay, I want to make $10 million. Like, go for it. You know, more power to you. I think it's more so about how you go about it and the way you execute that. So that way you're not just chasing after a number and forgetting about the sanctity of the cycle of life, the sanctity of how tea itself wants to be presented, how, you know, we can come into, I guess I'll just use the word harmony, come into harmony with that cycle of life and not to just trample over it. That's very important in whichever industry that you're in, because at the end of the day, when you go out to your community, is it just one on top of everyone, or is it that one that's able to raise everyone up to a higher level of understanding? And I think that when craft is done right, when tea is done right, when anything is done right, not just tea, it brings everyone in the community up to a higher level of understanding and makes the world a more beautiful place for everyone, not just for one person.
One final thought for tea professionals listening around the world. What should they remember about the way of tea?
Yeah, the thing that comes to mind is to have the humbleness to understand that there's many ways through life, and to honor each path that each person takes on their journey, whether it's in business, whether it's in your family, whether it's in tea, whether it's in spirituality, and remember the beauty of that. Because if we're all the same, my teacher would say, like, it could be quite boring. So the differentiation between humans, people, cultures, that is what we should celebrate and honor each individual's expression. So a lot, and why I say that is because a lot of times in tea, people will say, well, tea's should be this way. It should be served like this. And you can only do oolong this way. And you can only do puer that way. And you have to have this teapot. And you can see some rigidity. And I'm in the camp where there's no wrong or right way to do tea. As we said before, the best tea is the tea that you're drinking. So even if you're drinking Lipton, that's the best tea in the world at that time, you know, because that's all you've got. So no matter where you're at in your journey, whatever it is, that's beautiful. And also to recognize the beauty in another person's journey or expression of tea. And I'll end with this is speaking of the way of tea, like the way, which way? This way? That way? Right away, they sway with their way, but their way is just as good as any way, but not always are always the right way. But who has the right to say which way is right anyway? Following the flow of the tea is the only way.
My thanks to River for a conversation that moves from tea quality to tea presence and from business practice to community. You can find Drishti House, River's poetry, and a companion transcript in the show notes. This is Dan Bolden for TBiz. Intrigued by what you heard in today's podcast? Would you like to learn more from our global network of TBiz journalists and tea experts? Remember to visit the TBiz website for more comprehensive coverage. That's www.t-biz.com. Thanks for listening. Farewell till next week.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.